everybody. Let me start my stopwatch so we don't lose track of time here. My name is Phil Parr. Most of you probably know that who've listened to this show before. Our guest today is Dan Hollis from Dallas, Texas. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Phil.
Good to have you with us. I gather that you and we all know Susie Barnes because she has been a member of our list and been around with us for a long time. You and her went to school together.
We went to school together back in the 50s. I graduated in 1962, two years before she did.
So you're probably not quite as old as I am, but you're getting close to 60.
I'm past 60.
Are you, sir? Well, I made it 4 years past. I'll be five in October if I live that long.
Well, congratulations, man.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. Now, so you, let's get back. We usually try to kind of do a whole profile on people, start with their childhood. You were young. You were born in the early 40s, somewhere, I guess, around 42, 43, when World War II was just beginning.
That's correct.
And where were you born?
I was born outside a little town in Middle Tennessee called Mount Pleasant. I was actually not born in a hospital. I was born to poor folks. And a doctor came to the house and delivered me, kind of like Abe Lincoln, you know. I was born in not quite a log cabin, but a little tiny four-room house in the country.
And your folks did what? They farmed, or what did...
My folks were sharecroppers. My father was away in the military at the time I was born.
Oh yeah, he was he was involved in World War II, I suppose.
He was, yes.
And but back then, that time, it was pretty common for babies to be born at home. I don't think I was, but a lot of people were at that point in time.
Well, if you lived in a rural area, it's probably a little more common.
Probably so.
Than if you lived in the city.
Well, we lived in St. Louis, so I was born in some old hospital in St. Louis. So your father was away at the time you were born, and so you have brothers and sisters?
My brothers and sisters were there, two brothers and two sisters, and my grandmother on my mother's side was there, and of course the doctor and my mother, and that was it.
Are you the youngest?
I'm the youngest.
Are you the youngest? Is there any other blindness anywhere?
No.
Go ahead. You need to answer that.
No, there's no other blindness. I was born with my mother had rubella when she was 3 months pregnant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's my other line ringing in it. Can you hear that? Hear that? Listen.
I can't.
Yeah, that's my wife's line. They'll just have to wait. Anyway, no other blindness. So you had rubella as a child, measles as a child.
Well, my mother had rubella.
Okay.
And I think I probably did have measles.
Yeah.
I don't really remember, but...
But your mother had rubella during her pregnancy.
Yes.
And so she had a blind child, and did that fact discourage her from having any other children? I guess she was probably tired of having kids anyway.
Well, by that time, I think she was tired of it. And five kids on the kind of income that we had was a pretty good strain.
Was a pretty good stretch.
Yeah.
Okay, so they let you pretty well be yourself as a child, get out and fall and get hurt and play with the other kids, or what?
Oh yeah, I played with the other kids because I'm not total. I got out and played ball, and I got out and did whatever.
Really? Did you have more vision then than you do now?
I think that my vision is probably about the same now as it was then. I can't remember it ever being any better.
Yeah, how much vision do you have?
Right around 20 over 200 with my glasses on. It gets considerably less when I take them off.
So that's you can read large print?
I can, but it's slow and tiring. And so I still depend on Braille and audio material.
Talking books and digital books and things like that.
Yeah.
And so when they got ready to send you to school, they sent you to the Tennessee School for the Blind, which is a TSB, right?
Yeah, my mother took me first over to the into Mount Pleasant to the local elementary school, mm-hmm. and the principal and the teachers there discouraged her from trying to send me to school there because they said they didn't have the tools or the skills to deal with my problem.
And they didn't.
And so they recommended, actually they referred me to TSB, and the principal of the school came around to visit. And from that point was where they made the decision to send me to TSB in the fall of 1949. It was a tough pull because my mother didn't want to send me, and my daddy had to do some tall talking in order to get her to relent.
Yeah.
But it was a good choice.
Well, it was the only choice then, really. I mean, when you look back on it.
Given the amount of vision that I had, it was really the only choice.
I went to the Texas school, and every once in a while you'd get this boy off the farm who they just decided to keep home. He was blind, and he probably couldn't learn anything anyway. And you'd get him at 10 or 11 years old, and he was just screwed up. I mean, he rocked and flipped his hands and couldn't dress himself or do anything. So it was the best choice.
Yeah, I think so.
It's just really funny because Texas School for the Blind, of course, also would be TSB.
Uh-huh.
And when I hear you talking about TSB and here, Tuesday, I just thought, Tennessee School for the Blind would be the same. So you began learning Braille and all the things that blind kids do in a dormitory life, I guess?
Absolutely. And the difference between then and now is everybody learned Braille. No matter how much vision you had, if you came in the first grade, you learned Braille. And then later on, if your vision proved to be sufficient enough, and if your vision was holding up, they would move you into what they call sight-saving class. And I don't have any idea why they called it that. But they moved the people who could see well enough into classes where they used large print books and lined paper to write on and so forth.
And big lighting, lots of light where they could see. They came to our school and installed some big special. These lights must have been huge because you could hear them making noise when they came on.
I don't remember ever having anything like that.
Well, maybe they got a grant here in Texas to do that. But yeah, they put them in sight-saving class. So that's where you ended up?
No.
No?
I never went to sight-saving class because my vision was never that good. And I did, in the fifth or sixth grade, learn to type.
Uh-huh.
So I started using the print medium that way. And I learned to read print music in the fifth or sixth grade.
Uh-huh.
I had also learned to read Braille music, but I wanted to learn to read print music, too.
Yeah.
And so my piano teacher went right on and taught me to read print music, and I stuck with print music after
yeah.
that.
And it served you well, hadn't it?
Oh, yeah. I can't see well enough to sight read, to read and play at the same time.
Yeah.
But it to be able to use print music gives you access to everything everybody else.
Oh, yeah, to be able to see the chart, to be able to see the chart and at least glance at it and kind of know what was going on without it, would be a tremendous help in what you ended up, your career that you eventually pursued. So they taught you Braille and you went all the way through school at the Tennessee School for the Blind.
12 years.
12 years of it. Yeah. How did you like it there? How did you feel about that school?
I don't think that any of us really liked it there when we were kids. But when we all look back on it, I think that we all feel, most everybody that I talk to of my generation feel like we got a better education than we could have gotten in any other situation, given when we were raised.
Yeah.
And so how we felt about it at the time when we were there doesn't really matter much. It was kind of painful. to be away from your family. And if you had brothers and sisters, your brothers and sisters were doing things that you weren't allowed to do. And naturally, I think that was painful to most of us. When we started that little Dixieland band when I was in the seventh grade, things kind of changed for me.
That improved your outlook on the school a whole lot, huh?
Well, yeah, you know, where I hated in previous years when we got our summer vacation, when I hated going back to school in the fall, once we got that band started every year, I looked forward to getting back to my friends and my music.
Yeah.
You know, it was... I had something to go for. And I think that probably that's the way the guys, everybody who had some kind of extra activity might have felt. The guys on the wrestling team probably felt that way.
I imagine.
It having something a little additional to do other than just going to class and eating and sleeping.
Yeah.
Obeying the rules
would certainly make things better. I didn't get in a band in the seventh grade, but in high school we had a little band. We played dances and we played anybody that let us play, and sometimes for nothing. Quite often, but that sure helped a lot. I learned to drink and smoke. That's real good, you know. All those things they aren't necessary to be a musician, but most musicians do. Anyway, so your interest in music started early. I guess they have a big music department there.
You know, I started taking piano lessons when I was in the third grade, and they actually put me in the band when I was in the third grade. The first year I was in the band, I played one of those old upright E flat alto horns.
Yeah,
used to call them peck horns because all the only parts you ever got were offbeat parts, you know, rhythm things.
Mm-hmm.
Never got any melodic stuff to play. And then when I was in the fourth grade, they switched me to trombone. And at that time, I was such a little guy, the horn was taller than I was. The band director thought that would be a good instrument for me to play.
But your musical ability manifested itself quite early then, right?
Yeah, it did.
And you were still playing trombone, and you were still taking piano lessons, keyboard.
Right. The way the situation was when I was in school, it's changed now.
Oh yeah,
over the years. But if you took piano lessons, you had to have a practice period.
Uh-huh.
And if you were in the band, you had to have a practice period. So if you did both, a good part of your day was taken up with music. And
which suited you just fine.
I'm sorry, say it again.
Which suited you just fine.
It suited me. I was happy with that. I've had the first few years when, you know, third, fourth, fifth, sixth grade, when I was in about the sixth grade, I wanted to play basketball real bad. I'd seen the Boston Celtics play. I'd seen Bill Russell and Bob Cousy and Himeson and Sharman and those guys play, and I wanted to grow up and play with the Boston Celtics, but I eventually figured out I was going to be too short and too blind.
A lethal combination.
And a lethal combination, yeah, in the NBA.
It would be too short and too blind. I love it. and so your interest grew in music. But, you know, we've talked often, and this isn't the situation anymore. Used to, the main building in Austin, Texas, at the Blind School, you walk around that building and you could hear 8 or 10 different guys playing piano. You could hear somebody tuning a piano. You could hear some lady practicing her voice lessons. You could hear maybe just all sorts of music, different musics emanating from that building. And that's not true anymore. Was it? It was like that at Tennessee too, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. There were the elements who used to say that too much emphasis was put on music at TSB, given the fact that it's not a profitable employment. It's not. I will say this about the years that I spent in music. I wasn't really interested in being a star. I just wanted to work.
Yeah.
And so I learned to play a lot of different styles. and I learned a lot of tunes. And for most of my life, up until about the last 10 years or so, I've been able to make a really decent living either playing or teaching. I've worked in the public schools, and I've worked in colleges and so forth, and I've actually, with my music, have been able to make a pretty good living. You get older, and times change, and the fact that you've gotten older makes you less attractive to the younger generation that's doing the booking.
Sure.
And the music changes, and I'll be quite frank, a lot of the changes that have come to popular music, I'm not interested in.
Yeah.
I'm primarily a jazz player to begin with, but I'll play. You can call me a prostitute if you want to. I'll play whatever turns a dollar. But the changes in the music, I just haven't been able to keep up anymore because I can't make myself turn on the radio and listen to it.
I did just before I interviewed you, I did a kid that's just graduated from Berklee School of Music. And he's struggling, trying to figure out where he wants to go. He's an accordion player, and from what I hear, quite good. But like I told him, there was a time when I took any job, and somebody called wanted me to play somewhere, and to make a damn where it was, I went and played. Because I had to eat.
Oh, yeah.
I had kids to support. A wife who wanted a new dress, you know?
You know, the first professional job I played, I only made like $3, and the place was raided.
Yeah, I understand. So, but you'd play anything, country, rock, pop, didn't make any difference where.
No, I did. It didn't matter. I would rather have been somewhere else doing something else, but I grew up the last couple of years I was in high school, grew up playing a little bit with the musicians around Nashville, and the one rule that they all impressed upon me was you go and study music and you get to be the best musician that you can be, and if jazz is what you want to play, then you learn everything that you can learn about jazz because it's important for you to be the best musician that you can be.
Yeah.
But remember that if you're going to put food on the table, you have to know a lot of different stuff.
You have to play some commercial.
Yeah.
Or you can't, when I did music and or radio most of my life. I had a real good radio job and I got fired and I was about 40 years old. And I found myself, one week I was the morning man on the top-rated radio station in town, and 2 weeks later I was playing at a dump across the river. You talk about a humbling experience, and I thought, well, you know, what the hell, what would I have done if I had not known how to play some guitar? I don't know what I'd have done, but, it is, music is rewarding, but it's also frustrating, as you well know. It's not an easy way for a blind person to make a living, but it can be done.
I have a friend here in town who is the marketing director. In fact, he's the drummer in the band that I play in right now. He is the chairman of the marketing department at one of the colleges here. And what he says is that it's having talent, having any kind of artistic talent, creative talent, can be both a blessing and a curse. Because while it's a blessing to be able to do it, it's a curse because you don't get the same kind of respect from American society that businessmen and athletes do.
Hmm. Unless you're Stevie Wonder or Ray Charles.
Well, unless you're a star.
Unless you're a star.
I mean, it doesn't matter what you're doing. If you're a star and you're in the public eye, then that's a different thing. But if you're just a journeyman musician...
Picker, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm one of the things that little thrills about my life. I used to play at our country club here. It's called Crown Colony. I used to play out there, and I'd tell them after about the third song, I'd say, "Ladies and gentlemen, please hold your applause until after the songs, because it's really bothering me when you clap while I'm trying to sing." Because they never clapped. I was background music. They could have given a damn less whether I was there or not. And sometimes I'd get a laugh and some applause. Now I'm a member of that country club. And it thrills my heart to go out there on Wednesday nights. Now, you know, occasionally somebody will see me and go, is he fixing to play? No, I'm fixing to eat. In your little dining room, if you don't mind. Dan, let's take a short break, and we want to talk about places you've been and things you've done. Dan Hollis is our guest. I'm Phil Parr. Back with more of Blind Like Me in just a sec.
Blind Like Me list that I'll never forget.
Well, them crazy people on that Blind Like Me list just talk about the silliest thing.
To join the Blind Like Me list, send a blank email to blindlikeme-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. That's blindlikeme-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
Okay, I love being on the Blind Like Me list because I'm the moderator, and I get to delete people if I want to.
If you enjoy chatting with other blind folks, come join us on the Blind Like Me list. Send a blank email to blindlikeme-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. Here's a website our crack research team certifies screen reader friendly. Now, with this week's Blind Sight, here's Tim Cummings.
This week on Blind Sights, we're going to feature our very own Max Robinson again. Max Robinson, in addition to all the other things he does, is a musician. And he has a site called Max's Music Place, where you can go and listen to some of the songs he's recorded. He's been a lifelong musician, plays guitar and sings, and writes a lot of humorous music. You can go and check it out, listen to it, and also purchase CDs. The website is www.maxsmusicplace.com. I'd give it a screen reader friendliness rating of a 10. For Blind Sights, this is Tim Cummings saying, keep on blind sighting.
If you found a screen reader friendly website you'd like us to mention, send your email to blindlikeme, all one word, at txucom.net. And join us again next time for Blind Sights. Blind Sights. Here's a website our crack research team.
What you want?
Yes, we're getting exactly what I want. Just our guest is Dan Hollis from lives now in Dallas, Texas. Student graduate of the Tennessee School for the Blind. In high school, you played, of course, in their marching band. You had to in their.
There was no marching band at TSB.
But they're in their band, whatever.
I did play in the concert band.
In the concert band, yes, sir. And also in a, you said in the seventh grade, so you would have been about 13. You all started a little Dixieland.
We started a little Dixieland band, and that's where my interest in jazz started. Before that, I was into the, you know, I was into Elvis.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, you when you lived in a dorm with 30 other guys and everybody had a radio, it didn't make any difference what your interest was. You were going to hear pop and country music.
Yep.
Because that's what everybody else was listening to.
Yep.
It was after I found jazz. It was kind of like finding. It's like it's almost kind of like finding religion.
Yeah,
that's almost irreverent to say, but it,
no, it's not. It's fine.
My days and nights were consumed with. Because we didn't have much money to spend on records, we looked for it on the radio. And back in the 50s, when radio stations still had what they called block formatting, as opposed to
what they do now,
th- there would always be certain times of day that you could hear, you could still hear big band music and stuff. And so, and then late at night, there were like WWL in New Orleans, Dick Martin. You remember Dick Martin?
I do.
Dick Martin, Moonglow with Martin, and all of those 50,000-watt clear channel stations that you could hear that either had classical music or jazz from midnight on. You know, we would stay up on the weekends and listen. There were still live broadcasts from places.
From clubs in New York and things.
Yeah.
Yeah, and WWL was on all night long. That old boy was down there in the French Quarter, smoking half a temp of cigars and playing music all night long. One of the few big stations. Now, we mentioned Clear Channel. We're talking about stations that are on what the FCC used to call a Clear Channel frequency. In other words, WWL at that time was the only station in the United States on 870.
That's right.
650 WSM was the only station
on that frequency.
On 650. Now, there might have been a daytimer on that frequency, but they shut that sucker down at sundown, and you could hear those big stations, because there was so much less line noise, you could hear them all over the United States.
Oh, yeah.
And that was the point, to bring radio to places that didn't have local local radio stations. And so you were in a much better position than I was, because you were in Tennessee, much further east. You could probably hear the New York stations at night.
Well, what we could hear was, we could hear KMOX in St. Louis good, and we could hear the Chicago stations good.
Yeah.
And there was a station in Cleveland that had a jazz thing on the weekends that I listened to. A guy named Big Wilson, called himself Big Wilson.
At that time, that station was owned by Westinghouse.
Uh-huh.
1100. Omaha was 1110, remember? KFAB?
Yeah.
Omaha was 1110. Cleveland was, I want to say 3WE, but I don't think it was.
It wasn't at that time. It changed to that, and I don't remember what it was called, what the call letters were before that, but I sure remember the station.
It was the big Westinghouse outlet in Cleveland, Ohio.
Yeah.
And, of course, there was a lot of country on. I guess you heard the border stations, the XERF and XEG and those big stations broadcasting from Mexico. Could you hear those over in Tennessee?
Oh, yeah. You could hear Wolfman Jack, you know.
And Paul Kellinger, you remember him?
Called Paul Kellinger.
Yeah.
And Wayne Rainey and Lonnie Glosson.
Ah, playing their harmonicas.
Yeah.
Harmonica Course, XEG, Fort Worth 11, Texas, right?
Right.
That was it. I loved it.
All of that stuff. But we sort of fell into WWL and WGN and WBBM and those stations.
Yeah, you were going to listen to the jazz.
We were looking for the jazz. And we played so much. The superintendent of the school found he had discovered a good promotional tool. He would take us out to the Lions clubs and the Rotary clubs and to high schools all over the state.
Yep.
We were actually a touring group, if you want to put it that way.
Look what these little blind kids can do. Listen to this. These blind children can do. And the Lions club's always been big in donating, helping blind people. I suppose.
And the Colonel always collected some money wherever we went, you know. We didn't see any of it, but he collected it and put it in what he called the kitty, which was the student activity fund. And I don't resent that now. I sort of resented it then because, we weren't getting anything out of what we were doing.
You call him the colonel? Is that what you referred to your superintendent as, the colonel?
Oh, yeah.
Somehow or other,
he got that name. We called him the colonel. And,
so you did high school, and you got out of high school, and you thought, well, what, you know, you wanted to do music. What did you think?
Well, what I did was I went to Memphis State and majored in music. I left my parents' home in August of 1962 with a few ragged clothes and my trombone and my records, my small record collection and my record player and my $25 in my pocket.
Now, what year was this?
1962.
The Beatles had not arrived.
No, at that time it was. So, you know, the from 1960 up until the Beatles got here. Pop music at that time was sort of a vanilla. There wasn't anything unique, really unique, going on.
You mean since the advent of what we now call rock and roll back in the 50s when Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis and those guys
and
came
Little
along?
Richard and Fats Domino,
yeah,
and those guys.
Well, I fell in love with that stuff. I loved it. Oh,
and,
man.
And I still like it.
I do, too.
Much better than I did what came later.
Yeah. I did you care for the Beatles at all other than Eleanor Rigby and Yesterday?
I thought the early things that they did, because the early things were so much like the 50s rock and roll,
mm-hmm.
except that the chord changes were a little more sophisticated in some cases.
And you love that.
And I like that.
Yeah.
I thought the records were always well produced. The musicianship was good. They had a good producer. The guy that produced their records,
sure,
was musically knowledgeable, and I would bet had a whole lot to do with the direction that they took. But I didn't mind the Beatles. I got when the music got to be so loud.
Yeah.
And loudness for loudness' sake became the norm. Is when I drifted away from the pop music of the day.
I've got an interview somewhere that I did with Ernest Tubb back when he was alive, and he said, you know, Phil, you used to walk in with your two little flat microphones and your little Bogan PA set, hang your speakers on the wall, and entertain 600 people. Now you've got a bus for you, a bus for your band, and a bus for your sound equipment. You know, it doesn't make any sense.
No, and I see kids all the time back when I used to play the hotel lobbies here.
Yeah.
I would be down there playing my 5 p.m. to 11 p.m. lobby job, and up to the front door would pull this 18-wheeler.
Yeah.
Full of stuff just to play a wedding reception.
Yeah.
I just never understood it. I still don't now. Anyway, to get back to where I was with the education, I went to Memphis and had nothing in my pocket. I had been playing pretty regular in Nashville. Couldn't go to school in Nashville because rehab wouldn't pay for me to go to Peabody.
Why?
Well, it was a private school, and it was expensive.
Yeah, that figures.
Makes sense to me now. It didn't make sense to me then.
And your folks didn't have any money, so they couldn't help.
No, my folks didn't have any money.
And the commission would only pay for you to go
to a state school.
To a state-operated school.
So, there were state schools all around up there. Middle Tennessee State at Murfreesboro, and there was one up at Cookeville. But they're too small to play, and I wanted to play.
And so you chose?
I chose Memphis. I could have gone to Knoxville, to UT. I just felt like probably there was more going on, and judging from what the guys in Nashville told me, I would be better off in Memphis. So I went to Memphis, and
so
I did.
You...
Well, I was in the marching band at Memphis State.
So you rode a bus to Memphis and found you a dormitory, and there you were.
That's it.
Ready to go to Memphis State. They have a pretty good music program, or what?
They had, it was, the music school at Memphis State was small at that time. The music department was tucked off in one little corner of the administration building. And very few practice rooms, so you had to sign up for practice rooms.
Okay.
Because there were so few. A lot of us would get our schoolwork done during the day and then come back at night after the day students left.
To have a practice room.
To get a practice room. And a lot of us shared a practice room from time to time.
Now, were you trying to excel at trombone or keyboard back then?
Well, I signed up for private lessons on both instruments. I knew I was going to need them both. And I, at that time, really was more interested in the trombone than the piano.
Really?
But it's within 4 or 5 months of the time I was down there, somebody came along on a Saturday afternoon, a friend of mine who is now the president of, what's the name of that school in Beaumont? Lamar University.
Okay, yeah.
Jimmy Simmons, who was ahead of me in school, and he had been playing a job with a commercial band, and there was something that on that particular Saturday afternoon he wanted to do with his girlfriend, and he didn't want to go play the gig, so he found me around there and said, "Hey, you want to make some bread?" Okay, yeah.
Oh, boy, do I.
Oh, boy, do I. He said, "Here's the phone number. Call this guy, and he'll come by and get you. And you go over and play this tea dance this afternoon for me. And I'll see that you get paid." I said, "That's good."
Yeah.
I joined the Musicians Union when I got to Memphis. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know.
Now this was playing keyboard at a...
This job was playing piano. And when I got there, of course, I knew a lot of tunes from playing the trombone.
Yeah.
I wasn't, at that time, as good a keyboard player as I was a trombone player. But, and this guy liked me, and Jimmy really didn't want to stay on that job, so I ended up playing that Saturday afternoon tea dance deal. And sometimes we did a night thing, too. We'd play, like, from 3 to 6, and then from 9 to 1.
So you had a little income starting to, yeah.
Yeah, I, like I said, for a while there, I nearly starved to death because my parents, you know, the state had taken care of me for 12 years, and they thought somebody was just going to keep on taking care of me, and they didn't have any money.
Didn't have any money anyway. I've got a friend in Houston who's a trombone player, and his line is, "The height of optimism is a trombone player with a pager."
Uh-huh.
You might have something.
Well, back then, you could, if you were a good player, you could get commercial band jobs.
Yeah.
If you were a horn player. That's different now.
Oh, that's non-existent now, practically.
Yeah.
So you had a little income, had this Saturday afternoon and Saturday night, so that fed you.
And, it got me started, and as time went on, you know, over the years, I've developed to the point where before I left there in 1969, I had my own band and was doing some recording and one thing or another.
But most of it was done with keyboard, with piano.
Most of it was piano stuff, but I played an awful lot of trombone, too, especially on records. I played a lot of horn overdub things and played in the marching band. I played in the concert band. I played in the what they called stage band then. It was the jazz ensemble. I played in the orchestra. When people ask me about what I do, I tell them I've done everything from playing in joints where you had to hide behind chicken wire to keep from getting hurt when the fights start, all the way up to playing in operas, in orchestras for grand opera.
Yeah. You've done it all, haven't you?
I've had the opportunity to do all of that, and I'm grateful for it. I'm grateful for the patience of the people who were my teachers at Memphis State, and I'm grateful to the people that I went to school with for all the help that I got from them, and you know, because I had to memorize all that stuff.
Sure.
And when, like, the man who conducted the orchestra for the operas could have had somebody in there playing trombone who could see to read the stuff. He was patient enough to let me sit back there and memorize the stuff, and I always had it covered when it came time for performances.
But you were also, from what I've heard, really good.
Well, I held my own.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, you've played with some famous people and been quite a few places. Let's take a short break, and then we want to talk about what you did when '69 came and it was time to jump from college and go actually find yourself a job, which can be tough sometimes. I'm Phil Parr, and we're speaking with Dan Hollis. Back in just a sec, okay?
Best about the Blind Handyman List, great place to exchange information and gather ideas on anything to do with being a handyman around the house.
I found out how to fix my garbage disposal on the Handyman List, and it worked.
If you'd like to join the Blind Handyman List, send a blank email to blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com. That's blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
The thing I like about the Blind Handyman is I'm the moderator, and I can delete you if I want to. So don't get out of line. Stay on topic.
That's blindhandyman-subscribe@yahoogroups.com.
We're back again. Our guest is Dan Hollis, who now resides in Dallas, Texas. Born in Tennessee, went to the Tennessee School for the Blind, which is TSB, just like our Texas. We've got him through college at Memphis State University. Is that right? That's right, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They call it the University of Memphis now.
University of Memphis. And it was a lot of recording. There's a lot of recording done in Memphis, a lot of studios, and a good number of opportunities for a keyboard player, a trombonist, to do a little playing during his college years. And so we got you out of college, and it was time. Did you go back home for a stretch, or what did you do?
No, you know, I went home in 1963. I went home and spent one summer at home, it was not a good thing for me to do. And
yeah.
After that, I went home for holidays, and that was all. After that, I got myself a place in Memphis stayed there.
Well, there was nobody to play. There were no other musicians, good ones, that no jazz pickers in your town, and you need to be around musicians, didn't you?
Yes, and I was losing income.
Yeah.
It was just like sitting on it for 3 months.
Yeah, no point in that.
No reason to do
all
that.
All right. What did you decide to do when college was over, graduated to college?
Well, I was sitting on a master's degree, and I was working. I was playing 6 nights a week at a little place called Beale Street East in the Sheraton Motor Inn with a trio.
Yep. You playing keyboard?
Yeah.
Keyboard, bass, and drums?
Yeah.
Wow, love it.
And I had this. On hindsight, I probably should have stayed where I was, but I had this notion that I wanted to be a teacher.
Uh-huh.
And the guy who was the dean of men, who was a big follower of the jazz program at Memphis State, and who was a friend. He was a good guy and a friend.
Uh-huh.
Called me and said, "I've got a proposition for you." He said, "I've got a friend down in the Rio Grande Valley who needs a low brass teacher, an assistant for his band program down there at Edinburgh, Texas."
Oh.
He said, the money will be good. He said, you won't have to do marching band. He said, the head band director will handle the marching band, and all you really will need to do is conduct sectional rehearsals and teach private lessons. And I said, well, I'll talk to him. And I talked to the guy, and we liked each other. And he sent me an application, and I filled it out, and I ended up going to Edinburgh. And I only stayed for a year.
Yeah.
I got real sick down there. I was married at the time. We moved down there, and I got some kind of flu down there that just almost dehydrated me.
Really?
Yeah, I got really sick, and then I think that's where I developed the sinus problems that I have now, because I couldn't breathe.
Hmm.
You know, getting up every day and the humidity and the heat.
Yeah.
And it's that way the year round down there.
I was going to say that would be one of the last places I would want to live.
I even played down there. I got to be the house band for the Valley International Country Club while I was down there. Worked with Rusty Draper and Don Cherry. They were both members of that club, and they came down there from time to time to do shows. So if I could have stood to stay there, it would have been a good opportunity.
But you only stayed a year, and
I went from there up to I moved to North Texas, to the University of North Texas, where I started working on a doctorate of musical arts degree.
Now that's in Denton.
Yeah. I have had one overriding problem in my career. I can't stay away from places where I can play. Every time I've gotten anywhere close to being out of playing, something or somebody drags me back in. And I don't have a good reason for that, except that if you believe in any kind of, if you believe in fate, or if you believe in any kind of predestination, I would just have to say the reason I was put here was to play music.
Yeah, I was going to say, why is that a bad thing? I mean, you're a musician. You want to play, you know?
It isn't a bad thing, and unless you start counting your coins, and then it gets to be a problem. And this is where when I talk to kids, I tell them, I want you to be the very best player that you can be. I want you to excel. But I also want you not to ignore the rest of your education, because there are times when you go hungry if you don't.
And would you think if you had played less and taught more, or played less and done what more, you could have ended up with a little more cash?
If I could have found a place to teach where I could play and teach both, and been able to play with good players, I would have been a whole lot better off. But, you know, I came here and worked on that degree at North Texas for a couple of years, and went back to Tennessee and worked in a community college for a couple of years. And it was in a small town, and the people around there who were musicians were not up to the quality.
They were not your caliber, and so you didn't give a damn about playing with them.
Yeah, and not being able to play with the good players was hard.
See, my wife doesn't understand that. She thinks somebody calls me and wants me to go to a jam session. I ask who's going to be there, and if it's just a bunch of three-chord thumpers, I won't go, because that's not what I want to do, you know?
See, I understand that very well.
I know that she doesn't. Well, won't you? You always want to play. Won't you go play? Well, I don't want to play with them. You know, I don't want to sing Fraulein all night. It's a great song, but I've already done that.
It's like asking somebody if you're going to go play tennis, you want to go play tennis with somebody that you can beat every game, or you want to go play with somebody who's a challenge.
You want to play with musicians at your level. I don't want to play.
Better.
And my level is way lower than yours, but I want to play with guys that I can go, Jesus, that's wonderful. How'd you do that, you know?
What you want to do is play with somebody better.
Yep.
That's how you learn.
Sure it is.
And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to always be able to play with somebody better so that I could keep learning. And so Jackson, Tennessee, I spent 2 years there and eventually came back to the Dallas-Fort Worth area and spent some more time working on my degree. Got developed domestic problems and ended up in divorce. And
yeah.
That discouraged me, and so I just settled down to playing and got into teaching on, part-time, full-time, part-time/full-time/substitute/whatever
yeah.
I could find to do. But with regards to finding a really good full-time teaching job that I could manage with my visual acuity...
Never happened.
Not possible in an area like this because the competition is so stiff. If they've got a choice of hiring somebody with your same qualifications who's got normal vision, who do you think they're going to hire?
Well, that's always going to be the case in any field.
And
there are plenty of places to play in Dallas. If you
at that time there was a lot more music in the 70s here. Through the 70s and the 80s, I think things were pretty good here. I played a lot of hotel lobbies. I played with an awful lot of girl singers. The girl singers began to pick up an awful lot of the work. They formed their own little bands and started booking the country clubs and the weddings and stuff like that.
There are lots of them, aren't there?
Yeah.
Some good, some bad.
Yeah. And so I did a lot of that, and I played with a guy named Tommy Loy. Do you remember who Tommy Loy was?
No, sir. I'm sorry, I don't.
Are you a fan of the Dallas Cowboys? Did you follow the Cowboys at all?
To some extent, not as much as a lot of people, but yeah.
Well, Tommy Loy was the little bald-headed guy that, from the beginning when the Cowboys first started here, walked out in the center of the Cotton Bowl.
Uh-huh.
When they moved to Texas Stadium, he walked out in the center of Texas Stadium and played the Star Spangled Banner by himself on the trumpet before every Cowboy home game.
Really?
Up until the time that Jerry Jones bought the team.
Okay, and so he was quite a trumpet player.
Wonderful trumpet player, and had the remnants of a band that was formed to play in a place down on Mockingbird called the Levee.
Uh-huh.
And, the band was busy. When I started playing with the band was at the Levee. I started playing when I was first at North Texas in the early 70s. And when I came back to Dallas, they took me back in. Depending on what the personnel was and sometimes what kind of job it was, I would play either trombone or piano. And mm-hmm. I was with Tommy and I were together for about 20 years. And between that and the girl singer jobs and the hotel lobby jobs and the private teaching and working as a substitute in schools, I finally settled down to just doing substitute teaching at the Arts Magnet High School here. I did okay.
But now, before we run out of time and we're getting kind of close, you have played with some, for instance, you've worked with Doc Severinsen, is that true?
No, I know Doc. I worked with Buddy Morrow. I worked some with Jim Cullum and the Happy Jazz Band down in San Antonio. I used to call it the Jim Cullum Jazz Band now. I've played when I was in Memphis on record sessions with, let me name a couple of records that you can actually hear me on today that they play on the oldie stations. There's a record called Angel of the Morning by a little girl named Merrily Rush.
Just call me Angel of the Morning. Yeah. Angel, and I know it, yes.
The Box Tops, Cry Like a Baby.
Uh-huh.
Cry Like a Baby that came out in 67 or 68.
You're playing keyboard on those tunes?
I played trombone on both of those tunes and also a little Hammond organ on both of them.
Uh-huh.
That's that middle of the night stuff where you stay there till 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning.
I know about it.
Yeah.
They bring in pizza. Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. Everybody's tired and wanting to go home. Why do we have to cut it one more time? That sounded fine to me, damn it.
Yeah.
That kind of session.
Yeah.
So, see, but you've had a chance to play with some really good musicians, and I'm sure some really bad musicians also.
The thing about it being a lifetime professional musician is you get a little of both in terms of the quality of music. You get a little of both in terms of the quality of the people that you work with.
Mm-hmm.
In the music business, I've had the privilege of knowing some of the finest people on the planet and some of the trashiest people on the planet. And I wouldn't trade having known any of them, even the trashy ones, because I learned lessons from them, even.
Yeah. You never did have a drug problem?
No.
You never let that happen to you?
No. I'm guilty of drinking a little beer and occasionally a little taste of Jack Daniels.
But you were around that sort of thing all the time.
Oh, yeah. Through the pot and the LSD in the 60s and the people doing coke now, there were always people who took uppers and downers.
It's good to listen to those really fast old Bob Wills tunes to know they had good drugs back in the 1930s. You know they did. Because they're really... I mean, some of that stuff is so wild, it's just unbelievable.
I have a friend here in this area named Billy Briggs who used to play on the Bob Wills band.
Really?
And he was on the band in the 40s when he came out of World War II, went with the Bob Wills band,
uh-huh.
saxophone player named Billy Briggs. Outstanding musician.
And he's
in his 80s now and still plays.
Still alive and still plays a little bit.
Oh, yeah. I have a friend named John Anderson here who's in his 80s who was on the Stan Kenton band from 1947 to 1954.
But you came along just a little too late to get in that, didn't you?
I did. I've always maintained that I was either born too late or too early. Too late to be a part of the stuff, the musical stuff that I really wanted to be a part of, or too early to really take advantage of the technology that's around for blind people now and to maybe have been able to do a little music and to have developed some other kind of career, too.
Well, to maybe become a studio engineer and do producing and do some other things.
Yeah.
That just wasn't... Because, you know, back 20 years ago, the equipment to have a recording studio was so expensive. There were only, you know, 45, 50 of them in the country. Now everybody's got one.
Oh, yeah, you can produce a record in your garage now.
You can. I do it all the time. Dan, we're out of time. Sir, you've been a most interesting fella. I mean, I guess you still are. You haven't changed, have you? It's just been an hour of your life. I'm going to come by and take you out for...